Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the second part of our showcase event, Exploring the Listed Private Capital Opportunity. And welcome back to those of you who joined us for part one last week. We've got three more interesting companies presenting today. Our speakers are Hamish Mair, Managing Director, Head of Private Equity, BMO Global Asset Management, to talk about BMO Private Equity Trust. Peter Stalens, Managing Director, Portfolio Manager, CVC Credit Partners, to talk about CVC European Credit Opportunities. And Steve Tredgett, Partner, Oakley Capital, to talk about Oakley Capital Investments. I'm the Chief Executive of LPEC, the international group representing listed private capital, and in particular, the nine companies on this slide. We've got a mixed audience again today, I think. Some of you are new to listed private capital, others of you know all about it, and of course, many of you joined us last week when I did a summary explainer. Put simply, listed private capital involves closed-end funds that invest in a range of private assets. The funds themselves list on public stock exchanges, and this means you can buy and sell shares as you would in any other company. And it also means anyone can participate, not just those institutions large enough to participate as LPs in the large funds. But I don't plan to repeat my full introduction from last time. Instead, I'll put in a mention for LPEC's report, Accessing Growth Opportunities in the 2020s. You can find this on LPEC's website. It explains the key features of listed private capital, if you're relatively new to it, and it covers everything you might want to know. I will, though, do a quick recap of why you might want to consider listed private capital. First, performance. In the 10 years to the end of 2019, listed private equity, as an example, outperformed global public markets by more than a third, and that's allowing for dividend income and for fees. But also, because public markets are providing less and less investor choice, the number of companies listed on public markets has roughly halved since the peak in the late 1990s. And today, private capital is funding companies that have never seen a stock exchange, and in many cases, they never will. Fewer companies are now coming to public markets at any point at all, or if they are, most of their growth is happening before they get there. This is often because public markets are simply unsuitable for many sectors. They find private capital is better for their needs, more flexible, longer-term outlook, can provide them with reliable funding for longer-term growth strategies, so they can build value and also create more sustainable businesses. This means that there are now entire subsectors, technology-enabled industries such as edutech or health and well-being, plus many companies at the forefront of implementing ESG strategies that are simply not widely available on many public markets. In fact, many national stock markets, arguably, now have sector skews that no longer provide adequate diversification. In summary, then, listed private capital offers access to performance, exciting investment strategies, to companies' assets and often to whole sectors that are simply not available on public markets. Investors get improved diversification, and particularly in the case of companies, the opportunity to invest in those in a relatively high phase of growth. So to talk about what all this means in practice, I'll hand over first to Hamish Mair.
Thank you, Deborah. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Over the next few slides, I'm going to give you an introduction to BMO Private Equity Trust. I'm going to talk to you about the background of the trust, the distinguishing characteristics of it, and then I'll give you an update on long-term performance, how the portfolio has fared during the COVID-19 pandemic, before looking at how the current year is going in terms of exits. I'll also use a case study to illustrate one of our co-investments that has been a recent exit, and also talk about the largest underlying holdings, which will give you a feel for the spread of the portfolio before concluding. Basically, BMO Private Equity Trust has been around since 1999. It is a private equity fund of funds with a large co-investment component. It gives exposure to approximately 450 underlying companies. The portfolio is largely invested in Europe, but we have some investments outside Europe and in North America, about 15% or so. It is distinguished in that it focuses principally on mid-market buyouts. We also have an emphasis on so-called emerging managers, or prime managers, if you like. So these are up-and-coming management groups, which we favour because we think that the alignment of interest, incentive, and motivation of the management teams, both at the level of the companies and the funds, is as close to the background investor as you can get. And that has worked out very well in our favour over time. About half, or up to half, the portfolio is invested in co-investments. So this is directly into private companies where we're taking a stake alongside one of the lead managers. The current proportion is just under 45%. A couple of other distinguishing features. This investment trust was the first to take advantage of a change in the Companies Act back in 2012, which allowed the payment of dividends out of realised capital profits. And that means we can pay 4% of NAV out as dividend every year. We pay it in four installments each quarter, which allows our investors to benefit from the steady flow of realizations that we experience in a predictable fashion and with a growing dividend. The next dividend will be paid at the end of this month. It's too late. It went X on the 9th of July. We do believe in the benefits of gearing. An investment trust structure is well suited to using gearing. The cost of debt is far below the return that we'd expect to make from private equity investments, so it does enhance overall returns, and provided it's used moderately, it's a very good way of enhancing returns. The underlying portfolio that we have, as I mentioned, is very broadly diversified and is therefore a good platform on which to put some gearing. We do aim for a very broadly diversified portfolio by sector, geography, vintage of the funds and underlying holdings, and also a range of different lead managers. And this is quite simply because, in my view, diversification is the only realistic way of reducing the inevitably high risk involved in private equity. So this just shows the long-term performance. We've got the NAV and the share price. Total return there, they're quite closely correlated, although there are occasionally gaps between these two, which can provide a great investment opportunity for a buyer. And then the dotted line is the stock market. So the key point is that you invest in private equity in order to make a far better return than you can achieve in the stock market. And that's been the case for this fund, certainly in round numbers. Since we launched the fund back in 1999, if you had invested in our shares and reinvested your dividends, you would have made an annualized return that's about twice what you could have achieved in the stock market. And your actual capital gain over that time period would have been more than three times what you would have made in the stock market. So, you know, you are rewarded for the extra risk that you take investing in private equity. Next slide is just another way of displaying performance. This is one of the standard ways of looking at it. And you can see that, you know, most years we have a pretty strong performance. It's not the same every year, but the cumulative effect of that is really quite powerful. We've gone to the next slide to talk a little bit about the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. So, I mean, it has been a roller coaster. In the spring of last year, it was quite an anxious period for us and for all the managers in our portfolio and all the underlying companies, and there was a huge amount of effort put into trying to cope with the worst effects of lockdown, adapting businesses, mitigating the worst effects. And the diversity of the portfolio, the diversification of the portfolio really came into its own in this instance. Yes, there were some businesses that were adversely affected quite severely. You know, we had an underlying business that was a travel agent, which had its turnover go to nil. But we've also had other businesses that have benefited quite significantly from COVID. Most of the companies were in between, so they had to change and adapt to get through the lockdown successfully. Many of these companies were niche businesses with strong positions within their markets. A number of them had business models that involved recurring revenue. A number of them were direct plays on the move to a more digital economy, and several were directly involved in healthcare, which the importance of which had been brought to the forefront because of the pandemic. But one of the most important things was that the private equity model, where investment managers can become involved in the helping the businesses directly through advice and access to different services for management, that really came into its own, where helping companies access government support schemes, helping them in negotiations with banks, helping share best practice across the portfolio in terms of how they could cope with the lockdown conditions. You know, that was of real benefit across the portfolio. We did a triaging exercise to see which businesses would require refinancing, how much would it be, when would it be, how likely was it. And in fact, actually, the refinancing requirements, equity refinancing requirements, were less than the worst case that we'd anticipated. And so the portfolio has actually come through the pandemic quite strongly. We had a strong recovery in the fourth quarter, and that's continued into 2021. The investment trust itself has got a strong balance sheet. There's good momentum in its underlying portfolio. And as you can see, we are in a recovery at the moment. Obviously, we've still got these concerns over the Delta variant, etc. But the negative impact of the second large lockdown, if you like, is far less than was the case at the beginning of the pandemic, 15 months ago. And you can see that there are growth projections here at the bottom for quite substantial recovery in economies. And although it won't end up being precisely like this, we're confident that that will provide a very supportive background for the portfolio going forward over the next year or two. If you go to the next slide, this is showing you what's been happening in the current year. You'll have read in the newspapers, and you've probably picked up that there is quite a lot of activity going on, a lot of exit activity of selling private equity businesses. Partly this is patched up from a quieter period, certainly in the middle of last year, people working through their mature holdings. And partly there is a strong appetite on the part of the corporate sector and of other private equity to buy businesses that have come through the pandemic well and who have demonstrably resilient business models. So you can see on that list I've got there, I'm not going to go through all of them individually, some really quite excellent exits have taken place in the first half of the year. I mean, to put it in context, a private equity exit is a good exit if it's north of 2.5 times or so, and with an IRR in the mid-20s or above. So almost all of these are in that category. So this has been a very good start to the year, and it bodes well for the outcome for the full year. This is just a specific example. This is a good example of what can go right. So Dotmatics is a co-investment. And as I mentioned earlier, co-investments account for about 45% of our portfolio. This is where we invest alongside another lead manager. It's normally a lead manager that we've backed either in one of their current funds or with whom we have a long-term relationship. And they allow us to invest alongside them directly into the equity of one of their investee companies. And in this case, the lead manager was SEP, Scottish Equity Partners. We knew them very well. Actually, it's probably one of the groups we know best of all. I backed them when I was a mere youth back in 1996, and we've been backing them since. And we had this opportunity 3 years ago, or 3.5 years ago, to invest in Dotmatics, which is a software company which provides software which is used by the pharmaceutical and medical research industries for sharing information about new compounds that they're developing, sharing them securely within and across laboratories. It's involved in modeling new molecules. It's quite complicated. And most of these endeavors are with lots of different people taking part in them in different parts of the world. So they have to have the ability to share their findings in real time securely. And they use this software package to do that. 3 and a bit years into the investment, the business was growing quite strongly. If you go to the next page, you can see the rate of growth of the revenue. it attracted the attention of the US-based company Insightful Science, which itself is a venture capital-backed business backed by a group called Insight. And they have paid an excellent price for it. They can see that it's in a growth sector, that it has high margins, it has strong amounts of recurring revenue. And there are, in summary, there are really some quite strong tailwinds in this sector that are giving it a bit of a boost. And they have paid a fantastic price for this company. And the net effect is that we've made 8.7 times cost and a net IRR of about 83%. There's a small amount that's rolled over into the new company, so we could still have even more upside over and above that. So in other words, what's happened here is we put in £4 million that has come back as about £38 million. So that's a good example of what can go right. This is obviously one of our stronger exits. It's not completely exceptional, but it is at the upper end of what is possible. And it does show you the benefits of the co-investment model and of having a well-diversified portfolio that allows us a spread of exposures across many different sectors with different drivers. If we then move from that specific one to looking a bit more generally at the portfolio as a whole, this next slide just shows you the largest underlying holdings. The point I would make here is that we're not trying to play any one particular sector. Yes, we have got themes that are quite well represented across the portfolio, but those tend to be in quite sort of broad themes like healthcare or information technology. But we basically link these companies. The common thread is that they are well-led deals. They've got good lead managers. They've been bought well. They're in the lower mid-market, mid-market of their respective markets, tend to be niche businesses, and there's a clear investment thesis and growth plan. So the top one, Dotmatics, has now been sold. That was still in the portfolio at the end of March when this was done. But we've got others in there. Sigma is an electrical components company in the States, which is growing strongly, which may be exited later this year. We've got others in there like Ashtead, which rents equipment, which is used for subsea monitoring of North Sea oil installations and wind farms, and that kind of thing. That's growing well, and they're planning an exit there later this year. Another one is Hughes Gray, which is a builder's merchant. Started in North Wales, expanded across northwest of England into East Anglia, which is a deal led by Inflection, which is doing very well. We've got some businesses that have actually done quite well during COVID. So Pet Network is a pet shop chain in Southeast Europe, Croatia, where in common with what's gone on over here, pet shops are allowed to stay open all the way through lockdown. A lot of people getting pets when they're working from home, and also prioritizing spending on pets, which is part of something known as the humanization of pets. And that has meant that business has traded very strongly, and we're now exploring an exit in that one. We also had, on a slightly more sort of somber note, investment in the Italian funeral homes provider San Siro, which was based in Milan, north of Italy. This is the largest funeral homes chain in Italy. It had a strong year last year. Obviously, there were more funerals than usual, but also they, as the sort of industry leader, they were able to act as a sort of consolidator of other funeral homes companies. And there's the thesis there is working out quite well. We're about to acquire some crematoria in the north of Italy as well. And the whole idea of building a chain of funeral parlours seems to be developing quite successfully, and that business is doing well. Stax is the next one. This is another business which has done well through COVID. The original idea was that it was a clean room consumables, so cleaning equipment and things like that used in the pharmaceutical and electronics industry, but it also makes rubber gloves and masks and has therefore traded extremely strongly through the COVID period. So these are a couple of ones that actually are direct beneficiaries, but you can see there's a broad spread of different types of company there. So just to conclude, we have come through the coronavirus crisis well. It has had an adverse impact on most of the companies, but most of them have come through. They've been able to adapt, mitigate the challenges of COVID. There are some uncertainties that remain, but the direction of travel is pretty clear. The portfolio has proved to be resilient. We have been fortunate that the people that we've invested in, they seem to have coped extremely well. And I think that's typical of the private equity model in general. And many of these companies have emerged, you know, stronger and in some ways rejuvenated by the COVID experience. In terms of our own situation, we increased the size of our borrowing facility last year, which gives us plenty of extra headroom. And that, coupled with the exit boom that we're experiencing, means that we've got plenty of money to invest in new investments and to maintain the strength of the portfolio, laying the foundations for future growth, which we are doing both in terms of new fund commitments as well as co-investments. The exit environment is good at the moment. We're in the middle of a bit of an exit boom, and generally that leads to uplifts in value, because typically when a private equity deal is sold, it's typically sold at a good premium, you know, 30-40% above the latest carrying value before the deal was contemplated, and that tends to boost NAV. So, you know, crudely speaking, if you have a strong exit market, you're likely to get a strong NAV. And we think we're well positioned for further good growth in NAV in the remainder of this year and well beyond that, and to maintain our long-term record. So hopefully that has given you a feel for the company and the portfolio. And obviously we'll be able to take some questions later on. So with that, thank you very much. And I think I'm now going to hand over to Peter. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks, Hamish. Hi. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Peter Stalens, and I'm the lead portfolio manager for CVC Credit Partners European Opportunities. So over the next 10 to 15 minutes, I want to spend some time on who we are, what we do, our investment process, and then our track record. So on the next slide, you can see sort of where we fit into the larger CVC group. So as you can see, CVC Private Equity was set up in 1981. So we've got about a 40-year track record of investing in corporates. And in the meanwhile, we've got around 23 offices globally. The Asian private equity business was set up in 1999, and then the credit business was set up in 2005. And as you can see, credit is now the second largest business within CVC, and it's roughly about a quarter of the assets under management. So this particular strategy that I will focus on today was set up in 2009, and it was really on the back of the financial crisis, where some of the larger investors in CVC, as well as some of the most senior people within CVC, put some money together to invest in dislocated credit markets at the time. So a lot of these investors are still invested in the funds, and we've got a 12-year track record now. So on the next slide, I can talk a little bit about what we do. So as the name suggests, we invest in credit. And the fund has three main objectives, really. First of all, we want to generate a predictable and stable income for our investors. So we currently pay around the 5% dividend yield. The second objective is to provide some capital upside on top of the dividend yield. So our target returns over the medium term are 8%. And then finally, our strategy has little correlation with equity markets. And I'll come back to this point later on in the presentation. So we feel we are quite different than your traditional high yield manager. And there's a couple of reasons for that. I think the first reason is that we mainly invest in loans, whereas your traditional high yield manager invests mostly in bonds. So again, there are two major differences between loans and bonds. I think, first of all, loans are a floating rate asset class. So the coupon that we receive on the companies we lend to is really, it's calculated as a spread over LIBOR or Euribor or any alternative benchmark. So basically, in an environment where you have inflation and central banks could potentially hike interest rates at some point, this should benefit our strategy, given that we don't have any duration on the portfolio, and any hike in interest rates will flow through to the coupons we're receiving. The second major difference between loans and bonds is that loans tend to be senior secured in nature, whereas bonds tend to be unsecured in nature. And what does that mean? So most of the companies we invest in are privately owned, and they typically finance themselves using loans, bonds, and equity. And so loans are the highest ranking instruments in the capital structure, followed by the unsecured bonds, and then finally the equity. So if something goes wrong, the equity will be first impacted, then the bonds, and then finally the loans. And as we've got security over most of the assets, could be real assets, but could also be assets such as intellectual property, our recovery tends to be fairly high. And again, that's why loans tend to outperform in periods of stress or volatility. And it's just because if there were to be a default in the portfolio, the recovery is fairly high. And in general, loans are fairly difficult to access, except for some really large institutional investors. There aren't many loan products out there available for, call it, private individuals or high net worth individuals or private wealth managers. So that makes the asset class also fairly stable, because we don't really see a lot of in and outflows out of the market. So that makes that loans in general are a fairly stable asset class. And the second point that sets us apart from sort of the traditional high yield manager is the kind of companies we invest in. So around 50% of the portfolio is generally invested in what we call performing credit. So these are loans that we invest in at around par, we get a coupon, and that's really the basis for the income we're distributing. The second half of the portfolio is invested in what we call opportunistic credit. So these are loans that we try to source at a discount to par, and where on top of the dividends, on top of the coupon payments, we get some capital upside from the pool to par. And this is really where our investment process sets ourselves apart from our competitors. As being part of the largest CVC group, we invest in corporates, and we've got enormous knowledge within the company about every single industry. We know when we invest in something, we may know some of their customers, some of their suppliers, some competitors. So there's a lot of knowledge within CVC, and we all sort of work together to really make the most out of the investments we make. So basically, we invest in corporates. So we don't invest in emerging markets. We don't take any duration risk. We don't take any sovereign risk. And we've got a large team of analysts who are sector specialists and who know their industries inside out. And then finally, I can't really finish the section on investment process without mentioning ESG, because ESG is really a core part of our investment process. Again, as a lender, we don't really have the same kind of influence as an equity owner would have in the business. So we can't really influence management by voting for or against certain actions that management wants to take. However, there are other ways that we can influence management's behavior. And we've seen more and more loans and bonds as well, where the coupon is effectively linked to certain ESG KPIs. So if a company hits certain criteria, then the coupon on their loan would step down. Or if they don't hit these criteria, for example, reduction in carbon emissions or board diversification levels, or there are numerous KPIs that we could use to really measure the ESG risk we're taking. And if a company does well, we feel that our risk goes down, so which means we're quite comfortable given a small coupon step down. On the other hand, if a company doesn't really do anything to improve their ESG KPIs, then the coupon steps up. And that's really an incentive for management to do the right thing, actually. On the next slides, I'll talk a little bit about our track record. So as I mentioned earlier, the strategy was set up in 2009. And on this chart, we've plotted our returns against the FTSE 100. And we've adjusted both for dividends to really make the returns like for like. So as you can see, since inception, so over a 12-year period, we've generated just north of 9% net returns for our investors. This compares to the FTSE, which has generated 8.9% over the same time period. So effectively, we've provided our investors who invested with us on day one a similar return as the FTSE, but with credit risk rather than equity risk. And you can see really where the credit risk is important, and it's important in periods of volatility. So we circled a couple of events over the last 12 years. So you can see the Eurozone debt crisis in 2011, where the FTSE was down around 7%, and we were down around 3%. The oil price volatility, and then the Eurozone growth concerns in 2015, where the fund was roughly flat versus the FTSE down 10.5%. Then we had Q4 2018, where there were concerns about trade wars and global growth again. And the FTSE was down just over 10%, and we were down 2%. And then finally, the pandemic last year, where we were down 20%, and the FTSE was down around 25%. And you can see from this chart that a sell-off like we experienced in March 2020 is really unusual in the credit world. And we've seen a pretty sharp V-shaped recovery post the sell-off pandemic. And the NAV of the fund is now well ahead of where it was pre-pandemic. While if you look at the FTSE, we're still not really at levels where we were pre-pandemic. And we can show a similar chart versus the Euro stocks. Of course, if you plot it against the S&P or the NASDAQ, things wouldn't look as good for us. But that's mainly because of the large technology components there is in these indices and the multiple expansion we've seen in that industry. Finally, on the next slide, I'd sort of briefly want to summarize our strategy. So many investors that we talk to, they tend to be quite cautious when we talk about credit. And there's a lot of misperception out there. There's a lot of negative press on credit as well. And look, I'm happy to take any questions later during the Q&A or maybe later on if you want to keep on having a conversation with us. But basically, the way we look at credit is fairly boring and it's predictable. I mean, we don't have some of the opportunities that Hamish mentioned earlier or that Steve will mention later on, where we can make 3, 4, 5 times our money on certain investments. But the downside is also fairly low. And Credit Suisse has a European leveraged loan index, which they started in 1998. And this index has only had 1 year of negative returns since inception. And that was in 2008, when pretty much every single asset class generated negative returns that year. So the other thing that investors sometimes question is the liquidity of the investment trust. When you look at the underlying shares, there maybe aren't as many shares that trade on a daily basis as some investors would like. However, we've got some mechanism in place to really improve the liquidity. And one of the things we're using is the quarterly tender mechanism. So on a quarterly basis, all the investors that have been invested with us for 6 months or longer can sell us back their shares at NAV minus 1%. So we've seen a lot of investors, if they change their view on the asset class, or if they have some in or outflows themselves, they can readjust their position by basically selling their shares back to us. We then keep these shares as treasury shares, and investors who want to invest in the strategy and maybe struggle to find enough shares in the secondary market, they can contact us and we can reissue these treasury shares. So there is actually a lot more liquidity in the shares of the underlying investment trust than Bloomberg or any other tool would indicate. So finally, just like to summarize what we mentioned or what I mentioned earlier is basically what we're trying to do is offer investors a stable and predictable income. We're paying a 5% dividend yield. Over time, there should be some capital upside as our target return of 8% is higher than the 5% dividend we're paying out. And then finally, I showed earlier that there's limited correlation with equities and investors who are concerned about where valuations are in public equity markets often talk to us about how they can protect their portfolio against a future sell-off, whether this is driven by macro events such as the Delta virus, inflation, or whether this is just a concern about where valuations are in general. So this was it for my prepared remarks, and as I mentioned, happy to take some questions later on. But I'll first pass it to Steve at Oakley to present his funds.
Thank you very much, Peter. And good afternoon to those who have joined us. My name is, as Peter said, Stephen Tredgett. I'm a partner at Oakley Capital, and I'm going to provide you with a very brief overview of Oakley Capital Investments, otherwise known as OCI. So OCI is a listed investment company, as you'd imagine, and was established and listed in 2007. And it provides investors with exposure to a focused portfolio of high growth private companies. These are established, profitable businesses, typically growing EBITDA around 30%. So how does OCI achieve this? It does that by committing solely to the funds managed by Oakley Capital. So this is a listed direct equity, private equity vehicle, in contrast to a fund of funds, for example. And our closest peers are in type and performance, the likes of kind of an HG, an Apax, or a 3i. So Oakley Capital, the manager, invests in private businesses across Western Europe. We're particularly strong in Germany, Italy, Spain, and France. And we focus on three sectors, the broad sectors, but we'll give you some sense as to what we do in each of them. But that's technology, consumer, and education. And we have a particular clear focus on digital business models. So has this approach been successful? And should you invest in it? Well, on the first of the slides, we'll give you a little bit of detail there on the NAV growth. So the net asset value per share, you'll see, has progressed quite nicely over the last 10 years, and it shows a real gathering of pace of returns. The average five-year return for OCI has been 16% per annum, and that places amongst the kind of top three performers of companies of this ilk. And in turn, it's led to share price performance, and most notably, just as the obvious index compared to, we've indexed that against the FTSE All Share over the last 10 years, and you can see kind of a distinct level of outperformance. So the next slide, we'll attempt to tell you a little bit about what Oakley invests in. So I've got three images here of three sample portfolio companies. As we stand today, there's 21 portfolio companies that you get access to by buying OCI. And this will give you a flavor of the types of companies to invest in. The first on the left there is a marketing image captured from IU Group. For those that may know a little bit about Oakley Capital, we had referred to this previously as Career Partner Group. IU Group is its branding today. And it's the largest and fastest growing German university. And that's thanks to its focus on online education. Student numbers since we acquired the business 3 years ago have quadrupled from 15,000 to now close to 70,000, 60,000 at the end of the year, and nearly 70,000 now. Since we've owned the company. And it's a great example of the level of high growth we can achieve. IU grew its earnings last year by over 70%. The second image there is an app called Jamondo that sits within our 7NXT investment. And it is Apple TV's app of the year. It's Germany's leading guided online fitness subscription platform. And it offers consumers access to an extensive library, typically female, 92% of their subscribers are female, library of video workouts and training plans. Subscriptions there have grown from 200,000 this time last year to about 600,000 today. And it's still a nascent industry, with currently 14% of the fitness population really using online services. And I guess it's an example of two things. One of the many digitally native companies that are in the portfolio, and a typical strategy for us as we tend to invest behind the digital disruption curve. We're not necessarily investing in new technology, and we're often replicating the penetration of a digital solution that we've witnessed in one geography or location, and how that can penetrate another geography that has lower adoption. And finally, the third image there is taken from Ocean Technologies. Now, Ocean is the clear market leader in kind of regulated maritime e-learning. Now, what does that mean? In short, they provide remote training for tanker crews. It's a highly stable business. There's a lot of growth drivers there as there's more regulatory compliance and safety training required. And it's been established thanks to a combination of, to date, maybe six or seven different companies within the field that we've rolled up. And in this particular case, it's an example of a buy and build strategy. And this is a typical kind of strategy you'll see Oakley deploy, kind of building sector champions. On the next slide, we'll talk about what makes Oakley different. Now, the most obvious way we differentiate ourselves is in the way we source investments. And Oakley was founded by an entrepreneur, essentially to partner with like-minded business founders. That may not sound particularly revelatory in its approach, but what we've managed to grow is a network of business founders that we work with in combination with our ability to tackle kind of transaction complexities like carve-outs. And in combination, as a result of a number of things. One, we've now got over 20 business founders, some of whom we've backed kind of three or four times. And to demonstrate the strength of that relationship, that not only have they had a certain level of business success with us, that they're willing to kind of partner with us again. They haven't completely fed up by the experience, but they've also gone on to invest some of those gains into the funds themselves. So of the assets we manage, 200 million euros of those have been invested by the business founders we back. So it's great alignment of interest that helps drive them to continue to find more opportunities for us. They not only bring us opportunities, but the quality of management that we work with is absolutely key, and the proven quality of management. I mean, it's key to any investment success is the management you back. And I particularly like the stat that kind of 95% of cases, we finish an investment with the management we back. I don't know if that sounds ordinary or extraordinary to anyone, but in the PE world, on average, management are changed 50% of the time. And management are typically changed when there is a need for change, and maybe there's problems to resolve. So it gives to get to just some of the advantage we have in terms of the management we work with. This all means that we're very fortunate to do a lot of off-market transactions. So 75% of the investments we've made to date have been proprietary, i.e. that means deals that are acquired outside of a competitive auction. And 85% of the deals are primary capital, i.e. we're the first kind of formal private equity investment in a number of these funds. Up until then, they probably haven't really touched the financial services in any kind of meaningful way. So we're bringing more companies kind of into the hopper. And I guess that bears out two things. One outcome is not only we find exciting companies, but we also manage to uncover a certain amount of value as well in acquiring these businesses kind of below kind of market rate. And as is often kind of described to me, we're investing in developing and growing companies which ultimately become targets of the larger kind of global private equity funds we've recently sold to the likes of CVC, EQT, TA, and others. We're getting involved in the lower mid or the mid market in relatively messy deals, off-market deals, in a way that the larger PE firms just not interested maybe in coming down at that size scale, nor are they interested in the complexity that we have to deal with, hence the lack of competition. So let's look specifically at OCI on the next slide. And you'll see a pie chart here that shows the total assets of OCI, well, the equity assets, broken down by their look-through investment in each of the different companies. As I mentioned today, there's about 21. It's getting a busy pie chart, 21 portfolio companies. And you'll see they're evenly split across our focus sectors of technology, consumer, and education. But to give you some kind of notable themes or stats about that collection of companies, the first is that over 70% of the portfolio are assets that deliver their products or services digitally. And as I mentioned before, it's often this idea that we, you know, we're investing in that digital disruption that you'll see in real estate classifieds online or price comparison websites or in education where we talk about, you know, kind of online delivery of education. Another key stat for these companies is that 70% of them have some level of recurring or subscription-based revenue, which makes them, you know, incredibly resilient. It also means that, you know, when we, or if there's an opportunity to introduce a level of recurring revenue. And that, as you can imagine, ultimately when you come to sell the business, makes these businesses incredibly attractive, and the multiple at exit can reflect that. And then the other notable kind of stat is the average earnings growth. Now, of the 17 companies that we ended the year with in 2020, they grew an average EBITDA growth of 20%. Now, what's notable about that is that seven of those 17 endured some kind of COVID impact in their trading, i.e. that they delivered, you know, kind of slightly lower than or much lower than their pre-COVID budgets. But the other 10, some outperformed as a result of COVID. And four of them were modestly impacted, three significantly. And to give you some sense of the comparable impact, the average earnings growth in 2018 and 2019, respectively, was 30% and 28%. Of note as well, in terms of, you know, I guess one of the things as an investor you're trying to gauge is, okay, I've got an NAV, you know, is this a sensible NAV? Can I trust it? Is the growth relatively consistent? In terms of kind of trusting it from a valuation perspective, the average EV EBITDA of this portfolio, so portfolio companies, is about 11.8 times, which is feels relatively conservative when you compare to the average growth of that group. And also the other stat to provide you is that on average, when Oakley realizes a company, we do so at a 44% premium to the prices being currently or last valued at on the book. So you've got that confidence that often we often hold companies from a multiple perspective, pretty similar to the level that we acquired them, with the simple approach being that was the last clear bit of price discovery for that asset. And so actually the multiples don't vary much. Much of the NAV growth is entirely driven by that EBITDA growth until the point of price realization when you sell it, and which is why you get that big pop. A bit like when a company might, you know, successfully come to the stock market. And so to conclude, finally, some stats readily available, but just on the net asset value. So that's 728 million. That divides down by 633 million of total assets, 206 million of cash, which is there to be deployed as the funds draw down the commitments we've made to them, and 111 million of liabilities. You net those together, you get the 728. Divide those by the number of shares and you get the 403 pence, and that compares to the share price today at about 362. The other thing I would note is, though, that 403 pence is quite a stale NAV per share. It was the value at the 31st of December. And the next NAV update is scheduled for the 28th of July. So a couple of weeks and you'll get a new NAV. And I'll lead you to conclude as to whether it's a good opportunity to acquire the shares ahead of that. The other thing I would note is that the returns, I mentioned them early on about the five-year NAV return being 16%. What was kind of pleasing is in last year that we achieved an 18% NAV return despite the impact of COVID and despite the fact that we had quite a large amount of cash at that point on our balance sheet, which was a great defensive position to be in, but it also provided a bit of drag as well. I'll conclude there and hand over to the Q&A section of the webinar.
And we have a question for Hamish. Can you tell us a little bit more about co-investments, as I believe this is about 50% of your portfolio?
Yes, it's just about, it's 50% is the maximum that it can be. Currently, it's about 45%. So co-investing is basically when you're investing alongside a lead manager, but you're investing directly into the investee company, compared with investing in a fund. And the advantages of co-investment are that you generally have much better economics going into a co-investment than being in a fund. Sometimes there aren't any fees or carry. Usually there's some fees or carry, but it tends to be at a lighter level than if you were in the fund. And so there's less of a drag. And so in other words, you get more of the upside. And you also have the ability to choose which deals to go into. So there's an element of cherry picking. And so if that's done properly, you know, if you're actually selecting properly, it can augment returns quite nicely. And that's one of the reasons that we've gradually increased our co-investment exposure over the years. I mean, how do we get co-investments? Well, it's not just about having the money. It's about basically having the relationship with the lead managers. First of all, they need to have the requirement for a co-investor, which they don't all have. But secondly, they need people that can come into the deal that are going to be able to react reasonably, swiftly, efficiently, intelligently, and then in the deal be, you know, supportive, or at the very least be an amenable investor, so that they can properly sort of implement their strategy. And that doesn't happen automatically. You tend to have to know the lead managers for a while, build up a relationship, have a meeting of minds, because inviting somebody into the deal is quite a sort of intimate relationship in some ways. You know, you're sitting in the boardroom in a number of cases with them, either as a director or as an observer. And, you know, you can see the good things, the bad things, that, you know, watch them interacting with management. It's obviously quite a, it's not an environment where you would just invite any old person in. And so it takes time to build that relationship. And because we've been at it for many years, I think since 2003, we've done 80 co-investments across our range of funds. You know, we now have a reputation for being a reliable co-investor, and therefore we get plenty of deal flow. And like any form of investment management, it's about sifting the deal flow. So 90% of even the most sort of packaged, you know, sensible looking co-investment opportunities that we see are rejected. It's only about 10% will actually be implemented. But it has been a source of returns, and it's a bit of a halfway house between being a direct investor leading deals and being a fund investor, where, you know, once you've made the decision to choose the fund, it's a relatively passive activity beyond that. And so, you know, it's one of the distinguishing features of our fund that it has nearly half of its invested in co-investment.
Thank you. And a question to you, Steve. There seems to be a huge amount of money chasing opportunities in venture at the current time. Likewise, there seems to be plenty of opportunities to invest. How do you guard against investing in frothy areas of the market and avoiding auctions?
Thanks. Well, I guess a lot of what I was describing there in terms of our network of business founders is absolutely key. I think we're unlikely to invest. I mean, I wouldn't describe us as venture. I mean, we're very much PE buyout and kind of established funds. We're taking majority stake, unlike kind of typical VC investments. So whilst these are maturer, we're unlikely to invest in mature markets. Frankly, we do participate in auctions, and we regularly, if not in the majority of cases, are outbid because we're simply not willing to pay over the odds for assets. There has to be a level of information advantage for us in order to be able to participate in to buy any business. Now, that's often because we're backing the business founder who is the partner, and this isn't an auction. This is someone looking for a partnership to grow his business to the next level. And so to answer the question directly, avoiding auctions is one of our key reasons to find value. We're not going to invest in something just because it's an exciting area of the market. We also have the luxury of not having to invest in lots and lots of companies. You've seen, you know, the 21 portfolio companies that we have currently have access to through OCI. That's over five funds. And we probably are only making in the region of 4 to 5 investments a year. So we can pick our time and spend a lot of time working with partners until we make the investment. The other key thing with a business founder is they're not looking at the point when they partner with Oakley to exit, or at least not exit in full. So it's not the point of value maximization. It's actually the point of, okay, there's things I recognize as a business founder I don't have. I'm getting caught up in the weeds of administration. I need to bring on senior management. And I don't have M&A experience. I don't have internationalization experience. Or I may not have D2C experience. And that's the point when you bring Oakley on. And it's ordered then to build the business over a period of time. And so that it is ready in time for an auction.
Great, thank you. And a question for Peter. Do you think we're approaching the end of the credit cycle?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And it's a question I've been getting a lot over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And look, credit does what it's supposed to do. We sort of get an income on the investments we make, and we distribute that as a dividend. I mean, so default rates in 2020 in the European leveraged loan market peaked at around 2.6%. Since then, they've come down to they're just north of 1%. So it doesn't feel like we're at the end of the credit cycle. Of course, when people talk about the credit cycle, people often think about, okay, what if central banks start to hike rates, which would be bad for credit in general, because when rates goes up, the price of your bonds comes down. However, in loans, we don't really have that issue, because we just get paid more as central banks start hiking rates. So we're not really concerned from sort of a duration point of view or from what's going to happen with central banks. Fundamentally, we're not that concerned at this point in time. Again, we're seeing strong growth across most Western European and North American economies. Default rates remain low, and in general, it's a fairly good environment to invest in credit. And again, most of the businesses we invest in tend to have a 50% equity cushion below the debt. So even if valuations were to start coming down, it's got to come down a lot before it starts impacting credit as an asset class. So I don't think we're at the end of the credit cycle. I'm sure I'll still get that question several more times over the next few months and years.
Thank you very much. And for Hamish, what's the management fee and performance fee of managing the fund? And is it better to be in the closed fund rather than the liquid fund when looking to invest in the long term?
The management fee of our investment trust is 0.9% of the NAV. And there's a performance fee over and above that, which is calculated on a rolling 3-year basis. So if the IRR, using the sort of starting NAV, the end NAV, and the dividends received during 3-year period is above 8% over every rolling 3-year period, then the annual performance fee is 7.5% of the annualized gain. So that sounds quite complicated, but it does add to the management fee when we have a series of reasonable years. So last year, 2020, which was actually quite a strong year, the overall fee, I think, was up in the sort of, it was about 1.8%. So we actually probably essentially doubled the fee by adding the performance fee to the basic management fee. That's at the high end. Normally it would be lower than that. So that's the fee. I think that compares quite well with the peer group. I mean, most of the peer group have also got performance fees as well as basic fees that are in a similar kind of range or higher. In terms of whether one should be in a liquid private equity vehicle versus a a sort of closed, illiquid one. I think probably the comparison would be between an investment trust and a limited partnership. Well, I think it really depends on your requirement. I mean, if you actually think you might need to access the money anytime over your holding period, then you're far better to be in an investment trust, because you can sell out at any time and in different sizes. If you're invested through a limited partnership, first of all, most individual investors wouldn't really have the opportunity to invest anyway. You need to be, it's generally an institutional market. So unless you're very wealthy and you have literally millions to invest in individual investments, then it's unlikely to be a route that's accessible to you. But you've also got, you haven't got an ability to liquidate your investment within the lifetime of the fund. Yes, you'll get money back as the fund matures, but you will not be able to exit completely, which could have implications, for your estate or, whatever other planning you're doing. So in many respects, the beauty of the listed private equity sector is that you can get the benefit of being involved in private equity, which is generally an institutional asset class for larger investors. But you can do so by buying shares in the stock market in quite small quantities, and with the great flexibility of being able to sell and get your money back, or reduce your holding or add to your holding whenever you wish. So as it probably wouldn't surprise you, as members of the listed private equity association, we are basically in favour of people, particularly individual investors, getting involved through investment in our shares.
Thank you. And one for Steve. Why is there a discount to NAV, and are these reasons justified?
We could have a whole other presentation dedicated to talking about discounts to NAV and why they exist in the sector, let alone with OCI. To talk to OCI specifically, and I would suggest, that I think discounts are fast closing across the sector for a range of reasons. I mean, this is a small sector, not particularly well known sector. It's exactly why the role of LPEC is incredibly important to us, and why we support the work that's doing, and why webinars like this are important. It's an asset class that is relatively small, not particularly well known, and so it's unsurprising that there is levels of inefficiency when it comes to the pricing of these assets. If I talk to OCI, I mean, we are, I guess, less well known than much bigger peers. I think you tend to find with size and liquidity, the shares tend to be a bit more efficient, and so that in itself will help drive the kind of pricing of OCI. The number is coming down kind of every year, and I think that is on the basis of a number of things. One, a demonstration of performance. That's ultimately what drives you. The greater the confidence in shareholders in your regular annual kind of consistent performance, I think is key, such that eventually the shares will start to price in the growth throughout the year. What doesn't help is that we give our NAV updates on a half yearly basis, so it's not a particularly efficient way to do that. There's a long period of time which you don't know what's happening with the NAV, and then you get an update like we'll be giving in a couple of weeks time. We'll be changing that to quarterly. But still, you get kind of periods of, unlike with a public market stock, which is pricing itself daily, you'll get periods where the NAV updates are going to be old as you move to the end of that period of time. We have got a kind of history of kind of a lack of kind of corporate governance, for want of a better word, and it takes time to address those and to change the perception of the public market. So whilst we have done a lot of things to resolve that over the last 3 to 4 years, whether that's how we communicate our IR, our visibility, we've moved exchange, we've bought back shares, we've got an entirely independent board, the list goes on. Just because you've done those does not mean you've resolved people's perception of the group. That takes time and consistency, and so we're pretty happy that we'll keep doing that and it will continue to rate accordingly. We are a number of years behind, maybe 3 years behind some of our obvious peers that I mentioned earlier in HGA, Pax 3i, very similar performance, a little less known. They're trading at or above NAV, and I suspect that the OCI will follow course.
Thank you very much. And a question for all three of you, and we'll start with Peter. Listed private capital has a long-term time horizon. What makes you excited for the future at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I believe there's a lot to be excited about at this point in time. I mean, when I look at our markets in general, it is a market that is growing fastly. So when I look at the European leveraged loan markets, at the beginning of this year, the entire market was around 320 billion euros. Now that's, I think it's 350 billion euros, and it's growing rapidly. So basically, sort of a bigger market provides more opportunities for us, and the driver behind the market growth is really sort of the M&A activity we're seeing globally. 2021 looks like it's going to be a record year for M&A, whether that is private equity driven M&A or corporate M&A. But most of that M&A needs to be funded, and companies then come to our markets to fund M&A, and there will be companies that will struggle initially, and that will provide opportunities for us on the more credit opportunity side. But there will also be companies that will do extremely well. So a larger market for us generally means more opportunities, and that should be good for our investors at the end of the day.
Thank you, Peter. Hamish, the same question for you.
Yes, what makes me excited over the long term? Well, I think the growth of the private equity asset class and the way that private equity is becoming more widely accepted as a means of financing smaller and medium-sized companies internationally, that growth seems to me to be very well established and to be likely to continue for the foreseeable future. And I think that's a good thing, because private equity, you know, contrary to some of the press that you may see on it, is, in my view, a very constructive form of investment. It's a very constructive form of capitalism. You're investing in companies, you're backing entrepreneurial people who are generally creating wealth, not just for themselves, but for their investors and all the other stakeholders in their businesses, including their, you know, the employees and the communities in which they live. And so I see that growing quite strongly. It's only 5% or so of all investable assets are actually invested in private equity at the moment. And you can easily see that grow significantly, to some extent at the expense of parts of the stock markets, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And the other thing that personally sort of excites me is that we, through our investment trust and other investment trusts, can be part of the sort of democratization, if you like, of involvement in private equity, because at the moment it's very much a specialist investor's area. The knowledge base about it and the propensity to invest in it is, you know, it's limited, because people regard it as a bit of a sort of, you know, closed book. And through LPEC and through the other investment trusts in this sector, we can spread the benefits of private equity much more widely. So individual investors or smaller institutions could get involved and should get involved. And I think, for example, it's only a matter of time before DC pension funds, you know, money purchase pension funds, start to become much more heavily involved in private equity. And I think that would be a good thing. That would expand naturally the universe of opportunities that are available to the wider range of individual investors. And then if you look back over the last few years, the influence of the retail investor, if you like, has, you know, perversely actually shrunk, despite the fact the economy has been quite strong. And I think it's, you know, it's good for society that people actually do hold shares, not just in public companies, but, you know, indirectly into private companies. And we're a conduit for doing that. So actually being able to spread that word and, you know, propagate the knowledge of our sector is something that does excite me for the future.
Thank you very much. And Steve, the same question for you.
The danger of going third. I mean, I have to say that, I mean, I thought Hamish was on the money. I mean, I wouldn't personally, you know, I'll only be adding to what he thought. I mean, personally, you know, working with entrepreneurs, I mean, we have more opportunities than we've ever had. But bear in mind, we're relatively small compared to the bigger PE firms. We're kind of managing 4 billion, a few funds, and as I say, you know, four or five investments a year. But we have a pipeline of 170 opportunities at the moment. We've never seen so many. And that, some of that has been caused by the disruption of the last 12 to 18 months. Some of it's because companies have found them, their opportunities have accelerated, and now they're at a stage when they're considering kind of private capital for the first time. And so the sheer level of diversity of opportunities and the exciting level of kind of business entrepreneurial talent that we could back, to kind of echo Hamish's point, is really where the excitement comes. And for us particularly, we're working in areas that we're generally kind of drawn to and participating in the kind of innovation and disruption within some of those sectors. It is a great thing to be involved in. I think slightly as well, to kind of take Hamish's point on around the democratizing PE, despite some of the headlines, and you know, PE, it's very easy to describe private equity in a headline that says, you know, kind of monster PE does this. And the PE is although small in terms of the total number of assets, there's lots of different flavors and types of private equity. And you're talking here with quite, you know, progressive kind of PE managers and investors. And I think, despite what you remember, there is a real shift in PE, particularly amongst the business founders and entrepreneurs we back, that it is a very proactive, helpful and empathetic form of investment, in a way that the public markets, ironically, is less so. And I think that reputation is changing, and that in time will also, you know, create more opportunities for all of us in PE.
Many thanks, Steve and Hamish and Peter, for great presentations.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.